Our Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, the best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA-sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all three PA tracks, and PA Day at the races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.
Career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Dolly America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow, what other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtib.org.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back at the races, about 15 to the top of the hour, and speaking of old friends, it's been way too long between visits for Jerry Brown of Thoroughgraph fame, and delighted that we get a few minutes with Jerry this morning, talk about a couple of very serious issues that, among the issues that horse players deal with. Jerry, good morning.
Come in.
There he is. Yep. Jerry. Yep. Yeah, we're here.
Yep. Okay.
Hey,
Steve.
How are you? I'm trying to determine the last time I had you live, and we did do that. We did do that terrific show years ago, the Mutual Interest Show, with you and Steve Crist and Andy Beyer, Andy Serling, and Maury Wolf and Ted Mudge. And each of you took a half an hour and talked about an important issue. And I suppose if we went back and listened to it, Jerry, the issues would all still be dealing in some form or another to this day.
Yeah, that's about right. The motto of racing is, if it's broken, don't fix it.
Just let everybody deal with it as they might.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, the Lasix topic, which does not go away, and, you know, it keeps lurching toward seemingly, a resolution of some type. You've written several times publicly letters to the editor, TDN, and I think the forum has run some of your comments before, but you were going to get a chance to, you know, put this in front, your thoughts in front of the committee in Kentucky, and really didn't get that chance this week.
Let's start out with this. They call it a hearing for a reason. The idea is you're supposed to be able to hear different viewpoints. Well, the politicians are supposed to hear it, the public's supposed to hear it. What they did was they had two vets square off on which Lasix study was more accurate, and that's all the testimony they allowed. And that's not what they should be talking about. What they should be talking about, what the effect would be if you actually banned Lasix on the business, the industry of horse racing. And there was not a word in that hearing about that. As soon as those two vets finished talking, which took 10 minutes, they shut it off, and that was the end of the discussion.
And Eric Hamelbeck, I think. Eric, are you with us too?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Eric, explain what this hearing, you know, there's been a series of these. Explain what this hearing was going to be or alleged to be.
Thanks, Steve, and appreciate Jerry putting a lot of work into trying to get a very important side voiced. But yes, the Committee of Jurisdiction for this regulation, and again, it wasn't just including the LASIX portion, but the Licensing and Occupation Committee was there to be, as Jerry stated, the committee to hear the regulations and hear what we hoped both sides of what would occur if the regulations were to stay in place or move into place. The Kentucky HBPA has had the lead on this, and they have or were able to secure four witnesses, one of which included Jerry, and with the committee staff, had everybody listed. All the information for Jerry was set up to join the call virtually, and the committee be able to see and hear him. When the committee opened up, it was announced essentially that both sides could only have one witness. And, you know, it's been printed that was the norm. However, we were allowed three other people. The three of the witnesses were there live and would not have been let into the room were they not on the list from the committee staff. So we felt like we were not able to present the arguments properly. The one witness that was selected was Dr. Claire Finger, based on the fact that, once again, we try to point to science and research to dictate policy and not politics. And what we saw was a political move to finish the regulation and move it forth. So ultimately, by not acting at all, they didn't take a vote. There was no further discussion other than the points that were made and some of the opinions that were expressed. So by not having any action taken, therefore no deficiencies found in the regulation, it essentially became law or was put into reg and is now a rule in Kentucky, or those subsequent rules are now active in Kentucky.
And explain, then Jerry, I want Jerry to essentially get his chance to draw from or even read the statement, but explain the status of those rules, because, of course, a lot of this, Eric, kind of is tied to, the industry-wide attempt to forward a LASIX ban by starting out with two-year-olds and stake races, and then, with the horses aging along, phase out LASIX. Talk about where that rule stands right now in Kentucky after this week's after this week's fix was in.
Fiasco is a good word.
Yeah, right. Well, the actual regulation regarding LASIX now states, which they had already started, no two-year-old races here in Kentucky, and there are other states that have been doing this, is officially banned. And then starting in 2021, all stake races. Now, even the Blood Horse yesterday, in their infinite wisdom, wrote incorrectly for Kentucky that it's graded stakes, and that's incorrect. It's actually all stake races. Again, Kentucky is not a state where there's state bred races like others. But if you do compare what regulations seemingly have passed in Maryland, now theirs is stated two-year-old races and graded stake races starting in 2021. But that right now is the rule. Ironically, the commission posted some pictures on social media yesterday meeting with veterinarians to explain what had happened, and I thought, now here's the irony. Why didn't they have those meetings to plan all of those initiatives and get practicing veterinary input? So to me, it was a bit of a telltale picture, because you've got mass confusion. You know, mainly because I'm in Kentucky, but you have veterinarians that are phoning me, asking me now what's going on. And so there wasn't at least enough. Certainly they put out some information, but the changes are going to be difficult to understand and adhere to. And again, one of the things that I want to take just a quick soapbox platform to once again say, anytime we have now rules that are limit of detection, we are going to have struggles. And that's exactly what happened with the 48-hour NSAIDs and the stacking and the 14-day rules and this prohibited stacking. Again, if you look at international rules and they all want to compare it when it's convenient for them, international rules have screening limits. Even Lasix, for goodness sakes, you can have 50 nanograms per milliliter and still be legal. So don't tell me that there's not a way to administer these rules and not be limit of detection. Our laboratories are not uniform because they are not all the same equipment, and that's where I'm going to continue to beat this drum that we have got to get the laboratories uniform and we need screening limits because picograms and now in Pennsylvania even a femtogram is being called a positive. That is ridiculous and it is not common sense.
Well, common sense on this topic has been hard to come by. Jerry, step in and explain, you know, why obviously I think we have the general sense, but, you know, why is this so important? Why should players, you know, there's some school of player, I'm sure, that thinks, oh, we would be better off. Then it'll be a level playing field if no one has Lasix. Actually, it's the opposite. But your approach to this and why you've been on this topic for years.
Okay, I want to talk about this from a bettor's point of view and to some degree from a PR point of view. This thing has gotten totally twisted around. There is not even a claim, as far as I know, of a benefit to the business of racing from banning Lasix, let alone any evidence being presented to back it up. The idea seems to be they do it in Europe, so we should do it here. And aside from that not being good enough reason by itself, racing in Europe is completely different. They gallop along. They run hard the last part. Here on dirt in America, they're going almost full blast from the start. And if you break down the internal fractions, they're all tired at the end because they've been running hard the whole way. Even the horses that are passing horses and making up ground are decelerating near the end. They're under stress in the beginning of the race to the wire, far more stressed than they are in the distance grass races, Europe, and things like that. And stress causes bleeding. So, for starters, you cannot compare this with any place else, just for starters. Bettors fund everything in our business. They fund purses. Purses effectively pay the salary of everybody in racing, including yours and mine, Steve, and Eric's. And they also ultimately pay for yearling prices. Without purses to run for, people won't buy yearlings. Yeah, there's nothing to run for. But think about this from just using an example of a horse that somebody bet. Now we don't have Lasix, okay? This is in the future. We don't have Lasix. Somebody's on a lead, and the public bet this horse. Some number of people in the public bet this horse. Horse stops. First of all, we're not going to know whether the horse stopped because he bled or not. But we randomly handicapped that horse, and there was no way to quantify his chance of bleeding going in. So now we have random events that are going to happen, and there's nothing you can do to figure them out. But out of that race, this horse now comes back 3 weeks or a month later. A, we don't know whether the bad race is because of blood or not. B, there's only two possibilities going forward right now. He either comes back again without laces, wasn't treated, or without anything, wasn't treated at all, and he's more likely to bleed than not, or he might not, but there's no way to know. Okay, or he's going to be treated with something that's not Lasix, either legal or illegal, because that's the way this is going to work. The public is not going to know in either event. The public is not going to know whether he bled last time, and if he did, whether he was treated with something this time. So you have this horse being entered this race, the public having no idea what to do with it. At the same time, there are going to be people who do know, because they pay for that information. There are people who bet a lot of money, pay for information just like that. And you're going to see horses of 20 to 1 in the morning line get bent out of 2 to 1 and win by 10 lengths. We have created, we will be creating a market for insider trading, in effect. Okay, they were paying for information, and they'll be using that information to play into the parimutuel pools, which are a market. That is what's going to happen. It's going to happen every day, everywhere. And that's exactly the opposite of what regulation of horse racing is supposed to do. Regulation is supposed to protect the betting public. And by doing this, they are going to clearly make it easier for insider trading and worse for the betting public. Okay, this will ultimately result in people taking their money to games they think are more fair to them. Handle will go down. That will hurt purses. And one more point on this, which is people talk about PETA and the optics and all that kind of thing. The optics are far worse if you ban Lasix than the way it is right now. Anybody who's ever seen a horse bleed out externally knows how bad that looks, how graphic it is. And in the world we live in, which has been brought home again to us in the last few days at Kenosha and other places, everybody's got a cell phone. And you do not need a horse to bleed out on national television anymore. You just need somebody around with a phone at any place, at Charlestown. Okay? If they have a friend who's in PETA or they're in PETA, that photo will be on the calendar. And it only has to happen once. And that's not even the worst possibility. The worst possibility is that a race like the Derby, the horse on the lead bleeds and chokes and stops abruptly, and there's a pileup behind it. If something like that happens, aside from the very real cost in terms of equine and possibly human life, people will be out the next day calling for a ban on racing in this country, and they will have the public behind them, because the video of that will be shown over and over on television. We're going to run that risk every single time there's a major race on TV, and it only has to happen once. That's what banning Lasix does, and it does it for no gain. There's nobody even claiming a benefit to this. Just that's the way Europe does. That's why we should do it. Okay? So that's what I have to say.
Jerry, you've had this conversation, and there we're gonna also, you know, with the availability of having you join us, we're gonna talk about a separate topic. But I mean, you've had the ear of some prominent industry people for a number of years. I mean, that you've been working with. The Thoragraph figures are being used in a variety of ways by industry organs. And why have they been so deaf on this topic, in your opinion?
That's the right question. Okay, look. Basically, as Eric can get some of this better than I can, but there are basically two groups. There's two sides. The side that I'm on and Eric's on are people who make a living in the industry, the racing industry. They make a living in that industry, okay? And owners who are trying to participate in that industry, a very expensive industry, without losing their shirt. That's one side of this. The other side of this is a combination of two different groups. One are commercial breeders who think they'll be able to sell their urine for more money if they can basically push the idea to people out of the countries that we're racing drug-free. That actually came up at what I will laughably call a hearing this week when one of the legislators said that outright, that we have to protect our breeding industry. Okay, that is the, from a financial or business point of view, the only people who will gain from this are people in the breeding industry, or think they will, by the way, they probably won't, in the breeding industry, which is a separate industry. They provide a product that is used by the racing industry. They are not the racing industry. They're a different industry. They are effectively what military contractors are to the military. And we do not let military contractors determine military policy. But right now, that's what's going on. They have a lot of influence, especially in Kentucky, and that's what's going on. The second group is a group that actually, for the most part, not for the most part, always in my experience, acted in good faith, which is a jockey club. I do a lot of stuff with them. I'm trying to help them catch people who are using illegal drugs. There's currently something that's going to be announced pretty soon where we're doing more with them on that, and they are acting in good faith. But they view, the people in the jockey club are not in this as a business. It's a sport to them. And that's fine. It's a football is a sport. The NFL's a business. Golf is a sport. The PGA is a business. But if it doesn't work as a business, you're not going to have football on TV. The business has to be viable for the sport to exist at all. And because they're not in this business and because they're not bettors, they don't realize what the impact of this will be. That's what this is about. I mean, they don't get it. It's not a question of them not being acting in good faith. They're acting in good faith. They're just wrong, okay, because they haven't asked the right questions. So that's the answer to your question.
And Eric, fold you into that with a similar, you know, you've been regaled, you know, every time this topic has come up, and whether it's from the HBPA side or Alan Foreman and THA's efforts, you know, both organizations are attacked by, you know, mouthpieces as obstructionists, It's remarkable that, you know, like every other debate, it seems, in this country, you know, that if you've got a viewpoint and you've got real life experience and hands-on experience, that you would think that would count for more than, you know, than an external voices that have other agendas. But, you know, address from your perspective and the horseman side, you know, what you're confronted with, and also where you think this is going to go now, because it does feel like no matter what happens with the USADA bill, which is a separate topic, and no matter what happens there, it does feel like this LASIKs topic is, you know, heading in this regulatory direction.
Agreed. And I think, you know, the term that I use for Jerry's description, again, comes back to the haves and have-nots. I'm one of the few people that, along with Jerry, consistently try to explain that this is an industry first. I actually don't like the phrase the sport of kings, because when you look at, I'm going to say anecdotally, but it's very factual, that about 97% of racing is non-graded stakes, okay? And when you look at the participants, that's what many call the have-nots, because they're doing it for a living. So to me, I know that horsemen are going to adapt. I mean, hell, I've done that myself. You know, again, I've not been in this professional role for that many years off the farm and off the track. But horsemen are going to adapt. How they adapt and who is going to be an issue. Again, one of the things that I just don't seem to understand, when non-horsemen make regulations for horsemen, they don't take into account what's best for the horse. I've said it before, and one thing I'll still glorify Frank for, he always let us put the horse first. But you have a lot of industry professionals, mouthpieces, as you said, Steve, quite frankly, can't put a halter on a horse. And so if you look at it from the horse's perspective and what's best for the horse, and the reason why you still have AVMA and AAEP supporting the current usage and administration of LASIK, they're putting the horse in the best interest of the equine health and welfare first. I understand that everybody wants a compromise. I've heard it till I'm blue in the face. And, you know, maybe this shakes out to be the compromise. But at what cost? As Jerry explained, it could be detrimental to the industry. And I don't see how certain industries within thoroughbred racing have continued to buddy up with animal rights extremist groups that have been on the record wanting to end horse racing. And it doesn't take, you know, but one instance like what Jerry explained to take down an industry. And I think that certain animal rights extremist groups have proven that they can do that. And that's a fear for me, right? Because I'm a horseman at heart. I've literally never done anything outside of when I was a sophomore in high school until now. So It's fearful to me that the industry continues to put rules and regulations that, A, are not necessarily in the best interest of the horse, but also have no factual proof that it is the best thing for the horse. And in Jerry's description, or the industry, I mean, he's 100% correct. We've continued to say, and I do a lot of hill visits, nobody has proven Lasix has done anything wrong, and nobody has proven what benefit removing it is going to do for the business. Because I think, as Jerry explained, there is no benefit. Maybe some perception. And another phrase, and I've said it before, perception is reality is the wrong thing to put your model around. Reality is reality. Don't let perception drive your reality. That's what horsemen do every day. And we work hard to make sure that the horses come first, and we make sure that they're taken care of. Are there bad apples? Hell yeah. Absolutely. You know, but what industry doesn't have bad apples? We are swift to take care of them, and we do the best we can under due process to make sure the penalties are equal to the crime. But if we continue to drive what we're doing now, we're creating two classes of races. I mean, I chatted with a phone tag conversation with Dick Powell yesterday. You know, two-year-old races are starting to get few and far between, and what you're going to have now is two classes of races, one in a state where Lasix is prohibited and one is not. There are horses right behind me that are being scoped when they work, and if they do have a trace of blood, they will run in states where it's safe and they can use Lasix. And that's going to continue to happen. And again, that's not what's best for the industry, in my opinion.
Can I add something to this?
Of course.
Yes.
All right, look. Eric talked about a compromise. This is not the compromise. But there is, this whole thing is being presented as a false choice. It's being presented as either no one gets to run on Lasix or everybody gets to run on Lasix, and that's nonsense. Okay, the original rule when Lasix was first put into use was that right. You had to be scoped by the state vet to be allowed to run on Lasix. They stopped that. They just made it right. Now. You go, you say you want your horse to be on Lasix, this is on the Lasix list. So number one, if you really mean business about the goal should be that the horses that need Lasix get it and the ones that don't use it. That should be the goal, okay? And for starters, you start with this year's two-year-olds, next year's two-year-olds, doesn't matter. And you put in the old rule about they got to be okay by the state vet. That's how you start, certified. If this horse is a bleeder, at that point, they have the option of running on Lasix. If they exercise the option of running on Lasix, they carry a weight penalty. Anybody who runs on Lasix carries a weight penalty. You figure out what the right one is. I can do that. So I do for a living with figures. That can be done. Okay, you figure out what the appropriate weight penalty is. What you're doing at that point is taking away the incentive for horses that don't need Lasix to run on Lasix. Because they're going to be carrying weight, and they don't need to be doing it. So those horses are going to choose, the people with those horses are going to choose not to run on Lasix. If you do this right, in 3 or 4 years, you'll have 80 to 90% of the horses that run not racing on Lasix if the models that people use are correct about what percentage actually need Lasix or actually bleeders. You can get the vast majority off it. You can get those people 80 to 90% of what they want and still protect the horses if you actually don't have another agenda. If you're actually trying to do what's best for the game right. And for the horses, that's what you do.
It's been floated repeatedly, the weight idea and, you know, those options. I'll give a pro and con or a devil's advocate, Jerry, because I'm glad you brought this in, because I was going to go to you for a player perspective, because I had just started, getting an interest in the game and playing. So I don't, going back to the 80s, I don't remember the, you know, the non-Lasix era, you know, playing before, you know, Lasix was added in New York. And for you, it's probably what, about half of your professional horse playing career is the Lasix era, and probably half the pre-Lasix era.
Well, no, it's more than half is the Lasix era. Let's not get carried away. But the point is, but you're right. The key period was the period of time where Lasix was legal, but not listed in the program. That's the part that's educational. Because they used to only put the Lasix list in a racing office. And people would go down there and actually figure out who was first-time Lasix from looking on the wall at the racing office. And you would see exactly what I described before. 20-to-1 shots, get that down to 2-to-1. They run off the screen. Okay, and that is why Lasix is the only drug listed in the program. There is a reason for that. Being listed in the program, Lasix being listed, is the good housekeeping seal of approval for bettors to give them some security that they know this horse will not bleed. That's what that listing is for. And that's how it came about. Because of the insider trading that's going to take place now. That's why we have it listed in the program.
I'm going to let me add the devil's advocate part, which is the people who said that back then, when you wanted to get state vet approval, you would spray some blood in the horse's nostrils and say, oh, look, he bled.
Nah, Eric will deal with that, but there's a thing called an endoscope.
Yeah, well, sure. Well, they'll tell you that. Well, they'll tell you that you could put it in their lungs. I mean, that you could the way you give a horse even other.
But let's say that's true, Steve. You're still having them carry weight, and to no advantage. In other words, if they don't need the Lasix, all they're doing is picking up weight. That's the point of the.
Yeah, that's really the difference, Steve. Because, and you're right. I mean, you know, I was a kid when that was going on. But if you take it one step further and do Jerry's suggestion, now it's a weight involvement. So, you know, back in the days when it was essentially a script that allowed you to go on Lasix, there was no benefit or hindrance that, you know, not being it. But again, I do want to keep saying that there is prophylactic usage of Lasix. And you know, I've used this analogy in D.C. on many occasions. I don't want to equate Lasix to a vaccination, but ultimately it's a choice. And that's the one thing that continues to not get voiced is if you are an owner and you do not like Lasix in your horse, then don't use it. There is nobody that's forcing Lasix administration. But at the end of the day, I've learned from Dr. Copeland on many occasions, many times we've sat in Paris at Lille's and had lunch, and to hear his frustration of the movement to ban Lasix it gives you goosebumps if you're a horseman, because at the end of the day, he was there when it came around and told a story the other night about it. And so, you know, he will tell you. Veterinarians that have been around that long will tell you it is a progressive problem. And if you invest in a horse and you have an insurance policy that is inexpensive as Lasix is and does not have any negative effects that has ever been proven, then you should be allowed to administer. And for me, again, I working for the Stronix, they had the opportunity to not administer Lasix to two-year-olds, so we didn't. But you also had the opportunity to bring them home for 6 months. So that investment, those owners, that's where I see a lot of this coming down. Again, not taking care of the business. When you have an owner like Chester Thomas here in Kentucky who's invested millions into the game, who puts out an op-ed saying that he's not going to buy horses or run them in Kentucky, that's the start of this division that I'm talking about of different classes of races and different circuits, essentially. So I just want to continue to say that while I think Jerry's solution is a very viable one, I just want to remind people that ultimately the science still says for EIPH, absent anything else, Lasix is the legal medication that's best for the horse and in the best interest of equine health and welfare.
Right now, the basic idea is, I mean, aside from what Eric is saying, which I don't doubt, the basic idea is people race on Lasix because they can. Okay, the guy next to me's got it. I'm at a disadvantage if I don't got it. All right? And the way you offset that, again, is by penalizing someone for using it. So at that point, there is a reason not to use it. That's right, how you right. do it.
Which seems like a practical balance here. And I, out of curiosity, Eric, from that with that suggestion, because it, you know, it's been floated really from day one, and I think there was even it might have been Gulfstream, right, that might have had that as a condition, and I know that it was floated in other jurisdictions, and ultimately in some of the other jurisdictions it didn't go forward. But what has been the response when that's been brought up as an option?
Well, what I remember, Steve, is the initial Pegasus races,
and
I think it was the first year that they had the dirt and the turf. That was the offer. If you ran without Lasix, then you were given that weight allowance essentially.
And 7 pounds.
Seven pounds. So that's what ended up happening. I don't think anybody took it. That would be only off the top of my head, and I wouldn't want to be quoted wrong if somebody has proof. But I don't think anyone accepted that, and they chose to run on Lasix. And again, in that environment, you know, myself growing up in Louisiana and Florida, that's one of the environments, along with upper high elevations, that it's most needed to protect the horse. And again, I think it's a choice. I think the only way to do it is offering that weight balance. But I also want to still make sure we protect the horse.
This year at the Pegasus, if I got the story straight, you were not allowed to run on Lasix. And Philadelphia Daily News reported that at least two horses bled, but they would not, that the trainers were willing to say that off the record, that the horses bled, but were not willing to have the horses banked, because they don't want their, particularly stake level horses, to have the stigma, in quotes, of being a bleeder. So, again, you're not going to find out. And by the way, this, as Eric and I have talked about this, this idea that they're going to have horses not running on Lasix in stake races, going back and forth about stake races where they do run on Lasix, is absolutely insane. I mean, how are you supposed to handicap that?
That's the question. That's come up repeatedly, and it's come up already. It's come up sometimes. It's come up with horses that have gone out of the country, that have left North America to run. And right. You know, in a lot of cases, I mean, we knock on wood, I don't think we've heard too many, you know, anecdotally, too many issues with horses. You know, whether it was going to Ascot, whether it's going to Dubai, you know, that kind of a, you know, those kinds of trips. But again, it anecdotal evidence of that ilk being held up as supportive, you know, as supporting a Lasix ban, it's just, it's such a silly, narrow focus. It's a much broader discussion. And what's really troubling, and I've had this discussion particularly with Sid Fernando, is the feel in this from, you know, the most virulent and pronounced Lasix critics. This is a class war, essentially.
Right.
And it's a discriminatory bend from a segment of the industry that could care less about 25 claimers, and that a group of people that seem to think that if that portion of the game, from a certain claiming level down to the bottom, to the C tracks, that if that disappeared, that then the industry would be better off. And if it was just stakes and allowance horses, I'm sorry, that doesn't work. It is an unbelievably myopic and frankly, you know, elitist posture. That is, I've said for years that their interest is in essentially in doing this and pushing this. They basically want to have what Steeplechase is. They want to have a handful of boutique dates with their expensive horses, homebred and such, and there's our industry. And they'd be very happy if you know they were just handing each other trophies, and if the horse players went away, they'd be quite content. And this is, Jerry, if I'm not wrong, I mean, I was only 10, but in the 70s, when the advent of OTB was around, this is what we were dealing with. You had leadership that, you know, that said, ugh, we don't want to be involved with OTBs. Ugh, we don't want the t-shirt wearing slobs. We have no interest. And look what that brought us in New York.
Yeah, that was the situation with rebates, too. The tracks were very late to come to that, and there's an entire ADW business because of that.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to remember that racing had a monopoly on gambling for a long time.
Yes.
And so they didn't have to learn how to compete as a business. All they had to do was walk in the office and sit down every day, and they had a successful business. They were the only gambling game in town. That is right. Not true anymore. And what's coming up now with sports betting is a far bigger threat to our industry than lotteries or casino games or anything else. There's almost no overlap between, you know, casino players, or very little overlap, casino players and horse players. One is an intellectual exercise and one is not. There is some overlap between poker players and horse players, but there is 100% overlap between horse players and sports bettors. 100%. They're both games which are actually handicap a sporting event. And if we are not careful, their game has a much lower takeout. You can sit at home and watch it. Everybody understands their game. They grew up with their game. It's a tough fight to win under the best of circumstances. But if you make it harder, if you make them think they're not getting a fair shake, they're going there. They're not going here.
Now, similarly, and since you veered into this lane, Jerry, and Eric, please stay. I do want to take advantage of your presence to talk about another part of those topics. And you mentioned several of them, in that comment, and that includes essentially the information that is provided to players. You also referenced takeout. You mentioned the rebate structure. I'd love for you to take a few minutes, Jerry, and talk about this scandal, because it is a scandal, involving the GMAX equipment, the situation in recent weeks, the pick sixes, where now it looks like the computer groups are putting in a third of the pool to go after pots. Talk about some of these developments in recent months, because virtually every one of them is troubling.
All right. On the timing issue, we deal with Equibase and have for a long time. I think we were the first outfit that ever purchased online data, electronically got data from Equibase way back. They are working on this, and as long as they get it fixed, that's okay. But it just goes without saying that the industry should be making that, you know, that the only industry data source, you know, they have the only database at this point. Racing Form used to have their own. Racing Form, you know, flushed their own and basically buying data from Equibase. So you have what essentially is one database in the industry. It is imperative that data be accurate. I'm just going to say that. They had some problems with this timing system. They're working on it. Apparently, they're going to be going back to the teletimer in a lot of places until the wrinkles are worked out in the GMAX system, which would be good. And I anxiously await, the result of this. We have our own clockers that do hand timing, and we're now beginning to do video frame stuff, too. to check for our own purposes because we have to be accurate. People are paying us significant amounts of money to stay to be accurate. So let's see where that lands in a month or two. They're on it, and hopefully they're going to get it, you know, completely under control. And at that point, if it's not, I'll be screaming. But right now, apparently, they're working on it, and I'm okay with that because I do think they're trying to get it fixed. Okay, that's that part. The batch betting thing is a whole different ball game, and man, did you come to the right place on that one. Okay. That is the biggest problem that nobody ever heard of in our industry. We are giving a group of people who bet a lot of money electronic access to the pools, and there's all kinds of problems with that. At best, those people are being given last look at the pools. They've got the program set up, and with split seconds to go before the windows, before the, not the windows, the betting closes, they can put in tens of thousands of dollars in various combinations. They're scouring the pools for inefficiency, and that part's fine. The handicapping part is fine. I don't have any problem with that. And the electronic access part is fine if you shut them out with 5 minutes to post. But by letting them get last look, number one, you're giving them an advantage. And since they get gigantic rebates, it doesn't have to be that much of an advantage. And number two, you're opening the possibility of cheating. You're letting, anytime you let anybody electronically into anything, there's a possibility of somebody doing something they shouldn't be doing. And number three, that's why you're getting all these late odds flashes.
Mm-hmm.
Because huge amounts of money are coming in late, and if more than one, for example, of these groups comes in the same way, which very often they will, that's when you're going to see 10 to 1. And listen, I bet the horse ran third and four-star day. He left the gate at 18 to 1, and he crossed the wire 10 to 1 in a greatest stake race on a Saturday at Saratoga. You know how much money has to be bet for that to happen? I mean, that's an insane betting flash. And how are we, the regular honest handicappers who do not have electronic access, supposed to be able to look at that and figure out what odds our horse is going to go up? You end up looking at the will pays, which is what Andy talks about in the air all the time. And it's the right way to do it. It gives you a pretty good idea. But a lot of players aren't sophisticated enough to do that. And in many cases, somebody will take 6-1 who wouldn't take 3-1, and they end up getting the 3-1. And losing, which makes it even worse. But yeah, that's a, this is, those groups are, not the groups, this mechanism of having electronic betting is a cancer on the industry. They're choking the industry to death, and the industry doesn't realize it. They are vacuuming the pools, and the takeout, which would be, let's say, 20% when the takeout, mm-hmm. because they're showing a profit, becomes 25 or 30% for the rest of yep. people playing, which yep. is an impossible thing to sustain. You can't sustain that. So everybody's going to go away because they feel they haven't got a chance. This is another thing which drives people to other forms of gambling. Why not? If I wasn't already invested in this game and do what I do, that's what I would do. It's the logical move.
Yesterday, I went back 20 years and we played the Travers with Unshaded. I'll go back the same 20 years, Jerry, and bring up Maury Wolf. And Maury warned the industry 20 years ago in 2000 that if you let this entity have more than a fixed percentage of the business, that you would essentially choke yourself out. And I think the number that, Maury has addressed this on the show with me, and I think he said that you needed to cap them at about 15%, and now they're about 28%, and it or higher even. And it's a hidden layer. We've talked about it on this show for years, and I'm sort of proud of that. I mean, trying to warn people. And there were certain business entities in the game, track management entities, that were doing this surreptitiously and essentially killing the small player. It seems like they've figured out as many things as possible, in fact, to try to crush the small player as a going way of business. And it's unacceptable.
Well, I want to give David Moore credit. He figured this out a few years ago, and he
yep.
kept the those batches out of one of those pick five pools, right?
The late pick five.
He did see this as a problem, and hopefully that's still the case.
It
but
is.
But more racetrack executives have to see that. They have to figure that out. This is really a long-term problem. This is taking short-term handle that is going to, in the long term, going to kill you.
Well, we should mention that Peter Berube at Tampa and the team at Oaklawn, they've got caps in mind or in place on this topic. And frankly, I'm surprised that more tracks haven't actively advertised as, you know, CAW free pools, like the people that are advertising. I mean, look at what's going on at Indiana and Canterbury this summer with the 10% and 11.99% pick fives. Yesterday Indiana did $2.5 million, and they've been doing $2 million a day all summer. And the same thing, Canterbury's been doing $1 million. I mean, the Sampsons deserve tremendous credit for coming back again. They tried to do something so noble by, you know, the takeout slash, but unless there is comprehensive cooperation between the tracks to lower the takeout universally, it no one entity is going to be able. I mean, I guess we're doing it a little bit with the pick fives, which have been accepted as the low takeout. But frankly, it isn't even the multi race wagers that need low takeout.
Right. Yeah. I look. This is personally, if you're calling for the industry to get together on something, good luck with that. Okay, I mean, this is, you know, that I am not one of those guys who is automatically against federal intervention. I think it's got to be done right if it happens, but we're talking about people who just consistently do things that are bad for the industry, running the industry. I'm not the first person to say this, but the problem in our industry is the people who run it. And if they're not going to do the right thing, then somebody, it needs to be some centralized agency that does. Nobody's ever going to give up their individual power voluntarily. It may have to be federal intervention. I would obviously, as I made clear today, be extremely against the idea of that agency banning Lasix or doing other things that could be destructive to the game. But, you know, if we don't, you're dealing with all these competing entities who have their own interests to worry about it, and they're going to do what's good for them. And if somebody else bans something, they're going to be glad to take those people in. It's the way these people is this is, you know, I mean, there's plenty of good things about capitalism, but there's some bad things too. You know, I mean, it's, and there's a reason we regulate things.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Really, there is. I mean, you can have something, you know, regulation is what keeps these offenses from taking place.
Yes. As I've tried for years, I'm glad even under the duress of the circumstances that whatever it takes to get Jerry to come out and speak publicly, because there are few involved in the game as thoughtful and as committed, and you know, people listen to me, you know, talk, have heard me talk forever about Jerry's ongoing commitment to a product that he created, that he's always looking to improve, and you know, literally is all you need to win. Thorograph, visit thorograph.com, and Eric Hamelbeck of the National HBPA, fighting the good fight for horsemen and for horse players. Eric, thank you. Jerry, thank you.
Absolutely.
So much.
Okay. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Steve.
Jerry Brown,
you,
Eric Hamelbeck, and a very provocative hour. Let's take a break. I got to get one more in, two on the day, and we'll finish up with Rich Eng. It is Thursday. I lost track because no Haskin, and you know, we were a little out of whack, but that was time well spent. Back after this, Rich Eng.
It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California and Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeders Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, the best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA-sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all three PA tracks, and PA Day at the races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.
And lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, Naira, Dolly America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow! What other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Races. Thanks to Eric Hamelbeck and to Jerry and I sent them both a thank you note, and Jerry's so funny because he says, you know, I hate going into these. He says, but I always have fun and feel good about doing them afterward. You have no idea in all those years at the. At the barbecue, in particular, at Saratoga, and you know, every weekend we would have the Thoroughgraph seminars, and it's funny, even my friendship and you know, getting to know Jerry is tied to the barbecue, because for those of you that are old enough to remember this, the first seminars, the first sheets handicapping were the Ragazin guys, and. What would happen, I was working the barbecue, and on Saturday mornings, people would come, you know, to come up to the barbecue like at, you know, 9 o'clock, 9:30, you know, before, or maybe a little later, I guess, after the gates opened anyway, and say, is this the barbecue where the seminar is? And, you know, after about a dozen of those, I think 2 years in a row, probably 2002, I guess I started in 2001, so would have been 2001, maybe 2002, I sent Jerry, and I'd been a Thoroughgraph customer, and I sent Jerry an email. I said, you know, there's all these Ragazin users are coming to the barbecue and asking, is this where the sheet seminar is? And it was actually... in the backyard. It was back in the, you know, back by the Red Spring, which was another sort of barbecue area, barbecue tent area. So I said to Jerry, I said, how about a seminar here at this barbecue tent, my barbecue tent at Carolina Barbecue. And so Jerry said, you know what? That's a good idea. So the next thing you know, for the next, gosh, I mean, almost, I don't know, 12 years, 13 years, we would have Saturday and Sunday, we'd host the Thorograph users seminars, and you know, Jerry and Alan Benowitz and, you know, the guys, they would they'd come, and that's how, you know, that's how I got friendly with Jerry. And Jerry's also saying, as I, you know, kid about him not coming on the show, when I moved the show, when it moved to the mornings, first 10 to 1 and then 9 to noon, Jerry, getting Jerry up before 11:30 is not, I don't think, is track record is not strong. Rich Eng is an early riser because he's an East Coaster, and you grow up on the East Coast. How long does it take? Do you lose that, Rich, being an early morning guy, or after a couple of years living on the West Coast, do you start to, you know, sleep late versus what we do here on the East Coast?
Hey, good morning, Steve. And first off, before I answer your question, that sounds like a win-win. If you get Thorograph and great barbecue, that sounds like I can't lose proposition.
It absolutely was.
But as far as becoming an early riser, you know what? If a person is not an early riser, it doesn't matter what part of the world they live in. Because even though there's a time change, if you don't like to get up at 6 in the morning or 7 in the morning, you ought to get up at 10 in the morning. It doesn't matter where you live.
And I'm the same way. I mean, it's funny. I'd always thought my mother had told me I was born at you know, a couple of minutes after 7. But it's, as it happens, my father sent, I guess he cleaned out a safety deposit box at home in Connecticut. And mm-hmm. He mailed me my original photostat birth certificate.
Oh, wow.
From Long Island, at that time, Long Island Jewish Hospital, now Long Island Jewish Medical Center in New Hyde Park. And and I actually was born a couple of minutes after 9. So they say that if you're a morning baby, if you're born in the morning, they say that stays with you your whole life. I'm a notorious early riser. And then when I go to the West Coast, I don't adjust. I end up I'm up at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. I can't. There's no way.
Well, it would make sense if your biological clock was established when you were in the womb, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly.
then when you come out, yeah, you're still your biological clock stays with you forever.
I don't mind. I like being a morning person, and you know what? I'll tell you what wins the respect of horsemen is when I'm sending horsemen texts at 4:45. They don't mind. They don't mind when they answer right away. This morning I said I had to send congratulations to Michelle Lovell because I didn't do it yesterday right after the race, you know, for her winning the stake at Indiana and Wellington Wonder. And it must have been about 4. Yeah, it was about 4:40. And boom, right away, I got back. You never have to worry. After about 8:30 at night, 9 o'clock, you can't. They're asleep, so you can't text them. Mid evening, but you can text them at 4:30, 4:45.
That is true, Steve. One thing about horse trainers is most of them have never seen the ball come down in Times Square in New Year's. they're long asleep before.
Exactly, exactly. It's got to be tough you think about that for wives and husbands that are, you know. But the thing is, there's so many people that are tied together you know, that are race trackers. I mean, that that's how you come together. I mean, you know, Tina and I, she, you know, she's a mutual teller, and I was working across the bridle path with the barbecue. That's how we met. So, and you know, then there's so many husbands and wives that are, you know, that are race trackers that way. Well, Rich, the couple of quick notes. I mean, the sports action, well, it, right now it's going to be on pause for social reasons, but some feel about, you know, what, where things have been since we talked last week, and you know, they obviously, the you know, with the Derby coming at Oaks next Friday, there's got to be real nerves regarding players being able to bet in Vegas. The signal, you know, the signal status, has there been any change?
Well, you know, I'm glad you're asking, because we did touch on this last week, and I just wanted to give you and your listeners a heads up. But I have checked with people. I'm staying in constant contact with people. There has been no progress in the negotiations between the Nevada Paramutual Association, also known as the NPMA, and Churchill Downs Incorporated, CDI. There's been no progress. You know, going back into history, I've been out here more than two decades. A lot of times these business impasses get resolved at the last minute, literally the last second sometimes. But this one has been going on for a long time, Steve. You know, we didn't have the ability to bet on the Churchill product during their abbreviated spring meet. And, you know, there's... both sides seem to be dug in, and I hate to say something like that, but both sides do seem to be dug in. There's leverage from Churchill because everybody wants to bet the Oaks and the Derby and the high quality racing there, and then Nevada, you know, is trying to reinforce and protect you know, the market share here, and then pay what they consider a fair market value for the product. So we'll see what happens. Opening day at Churchill is September 1st. And, of course, the Derby and the Oaks are Friday and Saturday coming up soon. And I know there have been preparations already made with some of the casino companies here in Nevada, in Las Vegas, to book bets. And it's really kind of a tricky thing, Steve. You know, a lot of your listeners who are older might remember the old days of before pre-paramutual betting was involved here. Everything was book betting before that. And it made life a lot simpler when the paramutuals came in. But there are some people who still kind of remember how to do it, and they kind of have to bone up on it. But I think the one thing that would be a real negative is, since there have to be caps on the payouts, because a book couldn't stand to lose a million-dollar pick six, or, you know, something like that, some six-figure superfecta or whatever. But there have to be caps on it, so it would limit the kind of pools available to bet on. And if you do, and if they did offer some of these pulls, the caps could really put a cringe if somebody actually hits a nice bet and, you know, finds out they make $1,000 instead of $10,000. So there's going to be a lot of issues involved with that, with the booking the bets.
That's ridiculous. Just unbelievable. All right. Well, I feel badly. We'll keep track, and when we talk next week, Rich, and I'm going to guess, by the way, in fact, I just heard from Ed DeRosa, and again this year, Ed, I'm going to be involved with Ed and Donna Brothers, and I assume Gary Young. We've done the Twin Spires post-draw seminar the last, I don't know, three, 4 years, and so Ed just texted me to confirm about it for next week, and it occurs to me to ask. You'll have, I imagine, Oaks and Derby analysis available at BrizNet next week, Rich?
Yeah, Ed did reach out a query, and I said, you know, consider me in. I've been doing it for quite a number of years now, and I really appreciate the opportunity with BrizNet.com. So I'll be doing full card reports for the Oaks Day card, and don't know how many races are actually going to be on that card, but I'll be doing every single one of them. Same on Derby Day, so those will be available at BrizNet.com.
Let's take the opportunity with Rich to, as we do each week, get a couple of simulcast plays. And Rich's RaceDayLasVegas.com is Southern California analysis, and he also has been doing, you know, the dark day, like a like now, like a Thursday, with no Del Mar. He's been doing analysis for Saratoga. But I should ask, too, Rich, after last weekend, too, how'd you make out? It was a really fun card and tricky with some nice prices last week. That Pacific Classic card, which we'll talk tomorrow when Jay Privman joins us, we'll talk about some of the results. But how'd you make out last weekend?
I did really good. The sheet that I did really good. And, you know, it's one of those things where horse racing, the beauty of it is you don't have to bet every single race. But if you can find the right spot to jump in, you can do really well. And the sheet had some really good situations that luckily was able to take advantage of, and some of the subscribers were able to take advantage of. So that was good.
Outstanding. Well, let's take advantage of you being here. And I want to mention only two races. The storms, we talked earlier with Dick Powell, and the skies were holding. Anybody that follows Saratoga knows that the weather can get volatile. They are expecting now, they've kind of reassessed, and they're expecting thunderstorms to come through at some point. So here's what they've done. They've left two races on turf today, one on each course. The inner turf, mile and a 16th, third level allowance, the third race, remains on the grass, as does the seventh, which is, of course, the turf sprint stake for fillies and mares, the Smart and Fancy, which is quite good. The other four turf races scheduled today are now off the turf, the mile and 3/16th, second filly and mare maiden special, and then there are three MTOs in the fifth race, which is going to be now a sprint on the dirt, so reevaluate that group, and there's going to be a pretty heavy Rob Attriss entry MTO that should dominate, and then the sixth race comes off. That'll be 7/8 for three-year-old fillies, a 32 claimer. There are two MTOs there. And then the nightcap starter allowance is going to be a sprint. And no MTOs there, but maybe I haven't looked at that group to see who might stay in. So be aware, all right? Rich, maybe a play or maybe one play for the day, or what do you think?
Yeah, we'll go for two plays. Didn't get them home last week. Close but no cigar, but let's see if we can do it this week. The couple of horses I'll give out, Steve, are kind of like the scenario where you've heard the term, you know, let the jockey agent handicap the race for you. I'm going to take two horses where the jock's agent shows up with their rider on a horse that kind of, you scratch your head why sometimes a little bit. But let's go to the first race. The first horse I'm going to give out is the number four, After Prom Party. Ron Anderson opts to take this horse and put Joel Rosario in a real nondescript New York-bred maiden claiming, and this horse got beat by 12 lengths last time out. But lo and behold, here's Joel Rosario on. So I'll let Ron Anderson handicap this race for me. We'll try the four horse, After Prom Party, in the first. And a similar scenario is in the fourth race. I take two dirt races, so I don't have to worry about off the turf. But I take a look at the number three horse, Uncle Ned, 10-1 in the morning line. This horse went off at 50-1 last time out, and all of a sudden you see Luis Saez up, and you scratch your head, why is Luis Saez riding a horse like this, who figures to be a huge, huge price, and this horse is dropping from maiden special down to the maiden 30, so maybe they were told something pretty good about this horse in a soft spot like this. So at 10-1, I'm willing to take a shot there too. So I'll let the agents of those two jockeys, Rosario and Saez, pick these horses for me.
Good job. I'm going to give you a horse in the nightcap, and this is just a glance, with not knowing where the scratches are. But Malibu Mischief in the nightcap, this may be one of those cases where people are going to handicap a race for turf, and it's on the dirt, and maybe the mud. Malibu Mischief, 15-1 morning line, you got Kendrick Carmouche and on the rail. And Malibu Mischief, if, you know, sent a running when the bell rings, there you go. Bob's your uncle. The number one in the ninth, Malibu Mischief for me. Rich, I'll talk to you from Churchill next week. We'll talk Derby and Oaks and everything goes with it.
All right, have a great trip, and be healthy and be safe out there, Steve.
Thanks, Rich. Rich Eng, everybody. You follow Rich on Twitter, Rich Eng for Pro Pick, and of course, the author of Betting on Horse Racing for Dummies, coming to you from Vegas. And we're coming to you from an ever darker, and now I can see the rain the rain starting here. I want to thank Jerry Brown and Eric Hamelbeck very much for their visit. Rich, of course, and earlier, Tony Black. Good luck to Tony with Smarty Sox in that fourth race at Delaware. And Dick Powell, too, earlier this morning. Thanks to KC on the board. Good luck if you're playing today, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow. Weekend preview at the races here on SiriusXM.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on SiriusXM Radio.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California and Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.